This is a music show podcast. I'm Andrew Ford, and we're about to meet Tim Friedman. The last time Tim Friedman was on the show, it was 13 years ago. He's about to go off on a tour. He's going to be performing cabaret style in intimate venues, and he's teaming up again with the Whitlams later this year to record some new songs. He's going to sing an old one for us, though. This is No Aphrodisiac.
Letter to you on a cassette, as we don't write anymore. Gotta make it up quickly, as people asleep on the second floor. There's no aphrodisiac like loneliness. Truth, beauty, and a picture of you. You'll be walking your dog in a few hours. I'll be asleep in my brother's house. You're 1,000 miles away with food between your teeth. Come up for summer, I got a place near the beach. There's room for your dog. There's no aphrodisiac like loneliness. Truth, beauty, and a picture of you. There's no aphrodisiac like loneliness. Truth, youth, beauty, fame, boredom, and a bottle of pills. There's no aphrodisiac like loneliness. You shouldn't leave me alone. There's no aphrodisiac like a loneliness. Bare feet like a tomboy and a little crooked smile. Truth and youth and beauty, fame, boredom, red hair, no hair, innocence, and Saturday, and a picture of you. 40 shaved and sexy, wants to do it all day. With a gun-toting trigger, happy Missy named Kinky Renee. Tired teacher 28, seeks regular meeting. Masculine, musculine, nappy-clad, brutal breeding. While his wife rough wrestles with a puppy all a quiver on a wine-soaked strobe lit. Asiatic hall of mirrors. Dash of loneliness, there's no aphrodisiac quite like it. Truth, youth, beauty, fame, boredom, red hair, awkwardness, impunity, and a picture of you.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Pleasure, Andrew.
That song stands up nicely, doesn't it? Tell us about sending tapes of it to radio stations.
Oh, yes. It was a funny time in my career. I was about to quit 97, and I'd had a tough few years. Recorded this album, and we'd spent all the money on the recording, had nothing left. So my marketing budget was basically 30 blank cassettes, and I dubbed this song onto them, and I just wrote and texted on the front of the cassette a letter to you on a cassette, didn't say who it was from. And in those days you could get into this building at Ultimo without security.
Yes,
I just
yes.
walked to the back to the pigeonholes and put them all in the ABC and Triple J, and that was my servicing. It was a marvellous $8.20 marketing campaign. Luckily Triple J started playing it, and it just took off. It was when it became number one on the top 100, we didn't even have a film clip. So there were these 99 songs with film clips, and number one didn't have one because we didn't have the budget. We quickly went out and made one, but it would have been nice in retrospect to just have a blank screen after number two. Yes. When they played the videos. That's on Rage.
Right. In retrospect, you're performing now, you're off on tour, and you're playing songs which are mostly in retrospect. How do you choose them? How do you decide which ones you want to revisit?
Well, in solo shows, I think the lyric has to be very strong. And so some of the crowd pleasers, more rocky numbers I'll leave out. I'll do the stuff. Also, it's nice to arrange songs thematically. I might do, you know, three songs about young men's checkered history with alcohol, or I might do three songs that are more politically motivated, like I've written about East Timor and poker machines, or, you know, I might write a new one about a victim of the punt. So thematically, and that lets me talk because I like to have a little chat to the audience, a little fireside manner.
And do you change your mind about songs when you go back to your back catalogue, which is reasonably extensive? Do you find songs that you had sort of forgotten about or maybe dismissed and think, oh, this is quite good, I think I'll get it out and dust it off?
I think that's one of the pleasurable things about having a big catalogue is allowing yourself to revisit stuff that you've put on holiday for 15 years. Mm. By the same token, it's also good to go back and say, gee, that song from 1999 is tremendously undergraduate and I will never play it again.
Yeah.
Some of the, you know, just the protagonist's a bit cocky and it's not obvious that I'm being an unreliable narrator, so I won't risk it. And I will look back with more, you know, sort of critical eyes on a lot of stuff.
Did you change them at all? I mean, are they still evolving, these songs?
Oh, I changed No Aphrodisiac, which is one of the reasons I can do the outro, because whatever's piquing my interest that night can, including members of the audience, can find their way into the final raving lunatic couplets.
Yes, yes, but there's something about those raving lunatic couplets which is particularly appealing, I think. Do you have a process for writing a song, Tim? I mean, do you are you a 9-to-5 office hours sort of songwriter?
I'd like to be. I hadn't written a song for about 7 years until last month. I was doing other stuff. I was still performing and enjoying it, but I just wasn't writing. My mind was elsewhere. I like to start with a theme. So I'm writing 4 at the moment, and they're my little jigsaw puzzles. And I'm finding that the melodies are coming, the music's coming easier than the words because I'm a bit out of practice. But I had a good morning this morning, knocked off 2 verses of a song I'm enjoying. It's best when the music and the words come at the exact same time. You're sitting at the piano and it appears before you, but unfortunately that doesn't happen all the time.
And what about the actual style of the song? Is that something which also comes at the same time, whether it's a, you know, a rocky number or a ballad, or is that something which you work out in advance when you decide you want to write a song about this or that?
I think if I'm doing a minor chord thing that changes keys and et cetera, it's often going to end up being orchestral, and I'll try and make it tasteful. But if it's got 2 chords, frankly, it better rock. So I think the complexity of the tonality will often determine that.
Yeah, that's right. And if you're writing something which is complex anyway, you want people to hear and appreciate the complexity, so you have to slow it down a bit.
Indeed. And also leave room to move. When I get the other 3 fellows in the room in a few months, I'm not allowed to tell them what to do. It's a real democracy for that moment. Not at many other moments, but at that moment, when Terapai and Warwick are working out what they're going to be happy playing for the next 7 years, they better like it.
Are you surprised in a way that the Whitlams have this longevity?
Pleasantly so. We haven't put an album out since 2006. We're going to release new material next year. I am surprised. We can still do 3 nights at the Corner Hotel and 2 nights at the Governor Hindmarsh in Adelaide and a couple at the Metro in Sydney. I think it's really a product of the fact that we worked so hard and we had such high standards around the turn of the century. We played a lot, and there's a lot of people that came to see us who enjoyed it. And frankly, they just think, oh, I haven't seen them for 15 years, and they come back, and now they're coming back with their kids sometimes. And we worked hard, and we're enjoying the fruits of our previous labour, and the crowd is very loyal, and I love them.
And you've got, of course, you owe them some old songs, then. Otherwise, they're going to be disgruntled.
Oh, no, definitely. There's a core of songs which we always get played. I'm not going to be churlish about that at all. But I also think of the person, and there are some of them out there that have seen us 43 times, and they need something different to keep coming back the 44th.
That's
so
right.
So it'll be I'll get Jack to sing a different cover from the 70s, or I'll bring something from Love the City in 99 that hasn't been played for 14 years. And so it's a happy medium between keeping the oldies, the old fans happy and giving people what they want.
And keeping yourself interested, I suppose, as well. That's part of it.
Certainly. A lot of that is having had a really great band for 18 years. A lot of it is about muscles and being clinical and being happy that you're playing as well as you ever have. And all musicians will tell you this, and that's why often they will be interested and engaged and for their until the 80s and 90s is because what they're doing is they're having pride in their brain and their muscle skills. And if you don't play well, you lose your sort of self-respect in a way.
Yes. Arrangements, Tim Friedman. We've talked before, I mean, this is like kind of 13 years ago, about your collaborations with Richard Tognetti and Brett Dean and Peter Sculthorpe in particular. And I know you had a long-standing friendship from certain standpoints, a kind of an unlikely friendship with Peter Sculthorpe. And he did a beautiful arrangement for you, which we're going to hear a little of in a moment. But tell us something about how somebody from your line of work ended up a good friend of somebody like Peter Sculthorpe.
Well, let me preface my comments on Peter. I've only met a few great people in my life, and Gough Whitlam would be one of them. Peter is another one, and probably just one or two that are still alive that I won't need to mention. And the thing that distinguishes them is that they are so entirely civilized, urbane, polite, but at the same time broad-minded and a little bit naughty. We met at an awards dinner, and I was think by the end of the night I was carrying around his Ted Albert Award, and we were in God knows where, some bar in the Cross or something. And then we became friends, and then he agreed to do an arrangement with me. And sometimes I'd go out to dinner, I'd ring up, I'd think, what can I do now with this friend from London? I said, I know, I'll give them a experience that money can't buy. I'd say, Peter, are you up for a visit? And if he'd done his 10 hours of work, because his work ethic was astounding.
Yes.
He'd be sitting out at that horrible old piano in the back room at Willara. If he'd done his 10 hours on his 13th string quartet, he'd say, yes, come over. So I'd turn up with a friend from London, and we'd have a bottle with Peter from 10:30 till midnight. And we just got on and knew each other's lives and had a good gossip, and we were both discreet about each other. And I'd take interesting people. You know, he would have been 70. I was 37, he was 74, we met, he was twice my age. So he would have been 77. He just loved meeting new people.
Yeah.
I'd take an interesting person over there who edited a magazine in London or someone else, and if things went on too long, we'd go and sleep up in the guest room, and he'd get up in the morning and, you know, he was already working away at his 17th string quartet.
He always scrubbed up fantastically after those nights, didn't
That's
he?
Why it was a tragedy that I think that he died so young, because I thought he was as strong as an ox.
Yes.
Something went wrong with his treatment or misdiagnosis, because he would have lived to his 90s. He was strong, and he could, he would when he delivered to me, when he said, come over and listen to this arrangement I've done for you, he was really happy. He'd been working very hard on it for a week or two, and he said, oh, this is one of the prettiest things I've ever written. He said,
it's beautiful.
Like, he said, I feel like I'm, this is my version of Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
That's what he said to me. And he played it to me, and he was an awkward piano player, and the piano was terrible, but you got the idea that there were these beautiful things happening. He'd taken my quite simple four-chord song about the ocean, and it had just lifted off. Anyway, we started having a little drink, and I didn't leave that house for 2.5 days. It was, it was pouring, and we just had the greatest time, and we'd send his assistant out for another two bottles of the Australian champagne, and I remember at one stage going, what's going on here? I'm going to stop having a drink with Peter for an hour and just see if he's actually drinking. And I stopped, and the scotch was still going down. I said, no, he's actually doing this. I couldn't believe it. Beautiful piece of work. I really just thought he was going to do some incidental strings for me on top of what I'd written. But he ended up basically taking what I'd done and then just doing a 7-minute string version of it, which we then recorded with Tognetti on the album. But then later when I started doing orchestral concerts, we were lucky enough to get the whole MSO string section or Sydney Symphony string section to play it. I would stop the song in the middle and just walk off and just sit behind the second violins and just hear this most amazing, beautiful, lyrical piece of music, which is about the ocean. Even has Sculthorpe's seagulls.
It does.
What more do you want?
There is a moment, you hear it and you think, I find this hard to believe this is Peter Sculthorpe. And then there's a moment when that ostinato starts and the seagulls arrive and you think, yes, of course it's Peter
Sculthorpe. Because some people just have only heard some of his, you know, dissonant extreme stuff, don't realise that he could write anything.
Mm.
He chose to be like that because he was trying to express a feeling of the Australian landscape, etc. But in this instance, he had to write something pretty, and it's one of the prettiest pieces of string music you'll ever hear.
We should hear it. But what I'm going to ask you to do is if you could start off the song here in the studio for us at the piano.
Sure, I'll just do a little bit of it. This is what he would have heard then, basically, and then taken it away. And he loved it because he loved the ocean. He was actually a swimming champ when he was a teenager in Tasmania. So when I said, oh, what can we work on? I got this lyric about getting back into the surf after a big break. He said, well, that sounds good. Play that to me. And so this is what I played him. And then we'll hear, you'll see what I mean. This is it's just a live recording of the Sydney Symphony with us in about 2013, and I had it mixed. I've never released it. I just wanted to have a record of it for myself.
This is a treat. Thank you very much for coming in, Tim.
It's been great to be back.
I wake and the sun has returned, trees with their majesty back. I walk down to the sea, I'll borrow some wax. And I can sit out here like a teabag. No more exercise for me, I've made it out the back. Yeah, I'm breathing in the colors. Blue was resting up for today. While it was kicking back, they were glass blowing these waves. It's how the gum trees are stamped into the sky. And I could be 8 years old with these colors in my eyes. Yeah, and I'm waking up in a dream out here. The sun, it's so low. It's throwing its shimmers at me and it's skimming its stones. And I can sit out here like a teabag. No more exercise for me, I've made it out the bag. Of it too, but out here if you want a wave, there's another one coming soon. I'm not surfing, I'm sitting out the back. All the kids are dropping in on the old man on the plank. The kids dropping in on the old man on the plank. Thank you.
Tim Friedman's out the back and with a lot of help from the late Peter Sculthorpe. Isn't that a gorgeous arrangement? He put his heart into that. Tim is playing on his own at the Music Lounge in Wollongong on Thursday, and the tour takes him around New South Wales and the ACT and Victoria, and it finishes up at the Camelot Lounge on Thursday the 14th of November. That's in Marrickville in Sydney. All of the dates will be on the Music Show's website.